Welcome to Happy Hour. Happy Monday, everybody, as we get into an Overreaction Monday where I don't feel like most of the things I'm going to be saying about your Detroit Football Lions this afternoon are going to be overreactions in any way, shape, or form. Unfortunately, after the debacle that was yesterday's game, a game that should have been entirely winnable, a game that everyone basically expected you to win, so that certainly we all expected this team to win, and that very much proved to not be the case in very short order. And it finds us, as it often does, playing the blame game. Trying to assign blame for whatever that was. And there are two things that come to mind real quick in my mind. I can't speak for anybody else. But there are two things right off the jump that I feel are absolutely contenders in the blame game in some capacity, arguably three. We'll start with your quarterback play from yesterday. Jared Goff, two interceptions on the day. Should have arguably been more than that. And the first one you could argue wasn't his fault. There, again, arguably should have been more than even that. He was making bad decisions, making inaccurate passes, hurrying up on the checkdowns. I mean, everything that he could do wrong, seemingly he did yesterday. And it's hard to really argue in favor of Goff's performance in yesterday's game. And certainly there's plenty of blame to be assigned from what he did. But here's the thing. Despite all of that, the Lions offense moved the ball a fair amount on Sunday. You had something like 500 yards of total offense in yesterday's game. Goff, despite being a turnover machine and attempted turnover machine even more, still threw the ball 55 times, completed 34 of those, and still threw for over 307 yards, despite the obvious not getting any touchdowns on the day. Your rushing unit still went for 139 yards. You still put up in some total some 450 yards of total offense on the day. And yet you still lost. You held Baker Mayfield to 185 yards, 70 total rushing yards, a total of 265 yards of total offense, and you still lost that game. And there are two things in my mind that stick out like a sore thumb when assigning blame to this thing, and both of them fall on your coaching, particularly Dan Campbell and Ben Johnson. Let's get a couple things out of the way here. Your defense was about as perfect as you could have possibly hoped. Aiden Hutchinson ended up with like 4.5 sacks on the day. You can't possibly be mad at what your D-line did or your linebackers. I mean, even the secondary minus a couple bad penalties on Terrion Arnold. But your safeties are playing fantastic. I have no problems with anything your defense did yesterday. Special teams was, well, perfect. Jake Bates hasn't missed a kick yet. He also hasn't attempted one longer than 40 yards. But the point remains, he hasn't missed one yet. Jack Fox had a couple real nice plays. He pinned both of his punts inside the Buccaneers' 20-yard line. Oh, and he also threw for a pass. So there's that. And I'm not at all mad at the fake punt inside your own 20. I should be mad about that, but honestly, you need to do that to get A, the crowd back on your side, and get the and get the players back out of the malaise that team was in at that time. But this ultimately comes to two things, and those are in sum total the red zone. The offense inside the red zone was non-existent. The efficiency in the red zone didn't happen. You couldn't get things done when you actually got inside your own 20 or got inside Tampa Bay's 20. The other issue is what the hell was that at the end of the second quarter? Third and two. Why do you have the kicking team running onto the field at that point in time when Jared Goff hasn't spiked the ball yet? There is no, You could argue about a lot of other things that happened in yesterday's game. I certainly would be rather frustrated with Ben Johnson right now, given that Vita V basically died in the first half of that game, and you never attempted to establish the run at any point after that. Explain that to me. Like, you can't. Like, that should have been the point at which you just capitalize and just start running Montgomery and Gibbs and dare them to stop you. You didn't do that. And that was certainly something that contributes to the first part of what we discussed here. But back to that last play of the second quarter. You had plenty of time to figure out what you were going to do if that pass to the Sun God was inbounds. You had plenty of time to get your guys back up to the line for Goff to spike that thing, to get the kicking team on the field, and give yourself some points going into the half. What did you do instead? A total just sloppy mess that resulted in 0 points on the board going into halftime. I do not understand that. How something like that happens, and that completely, you know, Dan Campbell went and said, oh, that was on me, I screwed my guys over, and so on and so forth. Yeah, you did. You basically take away the chance to be able to come back later in that game and just kick a field goal and win it. Were it not for that mismanagement right there at that point in the game, facing either of those drives at the end where you managed to get down once again inside the red zone and, shocker, once again couldn't capitalize on it, could have kicked a field goal, could have taken the W right then and there. Even if you, when you had managed to put up a nice little three and out and forced Tampa Bay to punt and then recovered the ball back and got back down to the Tampa Bay 26. That point, my, wouldn't it have been nice to just be able to kick it and be done with it? And no, you had to go for it basically both times. And as a result, you end up losing. And I have questions about that last drive too. Like, You know that you have to stop the clock, and you pass out the middle of the field to Gibbs, who's like immediately stopped, and now you got to spike the ball and, you know, burn it down to do anything. And yeah, some of these the pass to Kennedy that ultimately ended up being the last pass of the game that they ended up saying was incomplete. Like, why are you throwing there anyway? Your shot is basically end zone or bust. Like, you know what you have to do. Why are you throwing up the middle there in that scenario? The coaching calls all the way around were questionable at best and malpractice at worst. And that's ultimately where I put the blame. I'd be curious to see where anyone else is on this. Like, I know that a lot of people are not willing to utter a single bad word against Dan Campbell, and I get it, but at the same point in time, it doesn't do any good to anybody to deny that what happened is what happened and whose fault it was, to so that hopefully we learn from it and it doesn't happen again. The other thing I kind of had a thought about, like, at one point there, you could have very well gone and tested out the leg of one Jake Bates. This is another one of those plays where I remained utterly confused ultimately as to, like, now is the time that we're gonna not try here. Like, they were inside ultimately the Tampa Bay 41. Would have been an over 50-yard field goal. But I mean, thus far your kicker had been perfect to that point of the season. You were running out of time. Jared Goff was just throwing picks and arguably should have thrown more picks. I don't know why you don't just attempt the kick there. I mean, ultimately, you did manage to, on the resulting play, they didn't even get past their own 27-yard line, and the drive resulted after that. What would the worst thing have been that could have happened if you actually attempted that? Like, he stood a good chance of actually making that. We know he's made kicks longer than that on that field in the past. Why not there? Why at that point do we suddenly go super conservative? Like, you want to get that, get your team somewhat rallied here to try and get the win. I just have so many questions right now, and things that really just have me thinking, like, was this team just bound and determined to stick to whatever the initial game plan was, no matter what, without any adjustments whatsoever? The Vita Vea injury should have been a game changer. That should have been, okay, we haven't really been doing a whole lot in the running game today. Let's go out there and have Montgomery and Gibbs just pound the rock and dare Tampa Bay and their D-line to stop it. That certainly would have been, you know, my thought, that would have been the easy course of action here. Because it's not like they weren't doing well on the day. Like, this was apparently Jahmyr Gibbs' day to be the star of the show in the running game. And he had a very good game. 13 carries, 83 yards. Can't be mad about that. Looked about as, with all, came out there with all the explosiveness that you've come to expect from Jahmyr Gibbs. You had a bunch of, a few questionable things. I mean, there was one of those red zone trips where you took a quick pass, you had a decent amount of room in the middle of the field, then tried to go down the sidelines instead. David Montgomery wasn't doing a whole lot, at least on the running side of things, so you did see them both heavily involved in pass protection, and so that was at least good. My other concern, where was Sam Laporta? Is this just going to be how this game goes, like how this team goes this season? Like, we have one day that's just going to be, here, today is J-Mo Day. Like, today, yesterday ended up being the Amon-Ra St. Brown show. It's funny, I was sitting watching this game with our good friend, LaPierre Main Street manager Jim Malt at his place, and he was just dogging on St. Brown so hard. Like, where's he been? Like, he didn't even play last week and all this. And then to watch St. Brown just basically be the focal point of the passing game this week was kind of nice. I do find it weird that they've been targeting guys like Tim Patrick so much this week. A guy who hasn't played an NFL game in like 2 years. Like, I'm pretty sure Khalif Raymond got more targets than Sam Laporta. I don't really understand why it is that he's not being worked. Like, we saw last year what Laporta can do. I would argue between, certainly on the pass catching side of things, and you can make a good argument on the blocking side as well, Laporta might be the best tight end in the NFL right now. And I submit to you that there's maybe one or two guys that could even come close to that. But that Laporta, in my mind, is far and away number one. Ain't Kelsey anymore. He's looking, you know, rather washed these days. I don't understand why it is that this team runs this thing the way it does. Like, is it? It's not even necessarily, doesn't seem like they're just trying to shut him down to the exclusion of everybody else. It's not like he's got more coverage on him than anybody else. Like, at some point, you got to spread the ball around a little bit. They're going to the same guy time and time again and wondering, why isn't this working? Which seemed to be kind of the case yesterday. I mean, Amon-Ra was getting the targets. No one else really was. I mean, throwing to Tom Kennedy, who I forgot was still on this roster, but like, Laporta can barely get a look? I don't understand that. And we haven't seen much of him in these first two games. I'm a bit at a loss here as to why that is. I know you've got a lot of mouths to feed in that offense, but it seems like a guy like Laporta should be getting a lot more of those than Khalif Raymond. I don't get that. It admittedly confuses the hell out of me why the calls that they're making, the guys that they're choosing to target, and it could be one of those weird things where, okay, next week it's the Sam Laporta show. He gets all the targets. I know this is a roster of guys who are, like, it's very much built around, like, the kind of attitude that a guy like St. Brown has. I don't care. I'm here to help this team win games. Not showboating. I'm not, you know, throwing fits that I'm not getting the targets I need to get. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to get targets to guys who are, well, expected to be a very integral part of the offense is certainly a very integral part of the passing game. I'm going to be curious to see what they end up doing next week in Arizona, for sure. But the coaching mistakes, like, you can't have another repeat of that last play of the second quarter yesterday. That is the sort of thing that absolutely cannot happen going forward if you expect to be a Super Bowl contender. And if you do, then you got to tighten that stuff up. Everyone has to be on the same page. Like, don't anybody, it's third down. Like, don't lose count of the downs, man. Like, it's third and two. Wait until Goff spikes the ball so you don't have a penalty that basically runs off the clock and ultimately makes it so you can't even get a playoff at the second quarter. I don't know. Am I off base here? Like, has the blame been assigned properly here?
I think so. I mean, I tuned in about midway through the third quarter, and I saw the Lions take the lead for the first time in the game and then lose it quickly. Saw Hutchinson just have a great day.
That he did. He was an absolute stud yesterday, and honestly, your defense all the way around looked great. I am a bit concerned with Alex Anzalone. Apparently, he's in concussion protocol at the moment, and that's unfortunate because that would be a massive hit if he goes down.
Yeah. Amon-Ra St. Brown, he left in the fourth quarter. He was in pain. Apparently, contusions. He had cramps. Doesn't look like it's anything major.
He should play next week.
Yeah, I'm hoping so.
That was worrying, man. Like, because he started limping early, very early in game.
About third quarter, he was limping. I was like, oh, here we go.
Oh, it started even earlier. It started before the half. Like, he was already, you could kind of see a little bit. He was walking rather uncomfortably to the point where by the fourth quarter, he's going, like, laying on the sideline and kind of, like, doing that, the dog, like, the butt scooting, like the dog scooting its butt across the carpet, man.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, no, you can't afford to lose him.
No.
But, from what's been said, it's, a contusion, cramping, and he is expected to be fine. The Lions won't get back on the practice field till Wednesday, and it's likely he probably won't even practice Wednesday because traditionally, if you get injured during the game, especially as bad as it looked with him, you would expect that he's not going to play practice Wednesday at all. So we should know hopefully by the time at least Thursday comes around if he's going to be okay. I would fully expect that we'll see him on the field on next Sunday against Arizona.
I would see a practice day being devoted a lot towards defense, especially with the long ball. Trying to figure out how to defend against that.
I'm not mad about that particularly. Of all the things I could be mad about with yesterday's game, you still held Tampa to 20 points, which you'll take that ultimately. That's not terrible. Like, the fact that you had as much offense as you did, you got to the red zone as many times as you did, and you did manage to capitalize on most of them, that to me is a far bigger concern, although not a long-term one, because I mean, Ben Johnson's usually good at dialing up ridiculousness in the red zone, so I would expect that's something that will be fine long-term. Your secondary, it is what it is, man. Like, it's a lot of, like, we just cobbled a lot of this together. Like, it's a lot of new pieces in the offseason. Terrion Arnold is still a rookie. Like, he's had some good plays, but he is only on his second game of the National Football League. There was the one busted coverage that did lead to the touchdown, which I'm pretty sure is exactly what you're talking about. But there was a little too much give being allowed on the, like, on short yardage and things. And Carlton Davis did not have a great day either. Thankfully, when you have guys like Brian Branch just breaking up passes like crazy, that tends to lessen the worry there when it comes to these things. Yeah, I'm not thrilled with Terrion Arnold's play yesterday. Mayfield ended up finishing with 9.7 yards per pass attempt. Not great. You'd like to see better numbers than that out of this defense. If there's one gripe I could have with the defense, it's that. But for me, ultimately, your problems are on the offense. Like, everything, all those things could have been non-factors. Like, I know there's people complaining about a couple calls and things that happened, but, like, ultimately, if you don't leave the points that you left on the field, and there's one big thing that keeps coming back to me with that, and you know what play that is. If it wasn't for the fact that you're leaving all these points on the field, you know, in the red zone, none of that would have been an issue. The Terrion Arnold thing could just be, all right, whatever. That's growing pains on the part of a rookie corner, and corners traditionally a hard position to come in from college and play at a good to great NFL level. That's just kind of how that goes. I mean, we saw the growing pains certainly from Jeff Okuda, which also, again, why you don't draft corners that early in the draft, but that being what it is, like, you're going to expect a little bit of growing pain getting adjusted to the speed of the NFL game. That just happens. That's just, there's really nothing you can do about that ultimately. Like, he's going to get there. He's already showing some flashes of some good things, but Sunday was certainly not his best game. But again, we don't, if Goff doesn't, you know, doesn't throw a pick or you know, you run the ball a couple more times with Montgomery and Gibbs after he gets hurt, I don't feel like you're even talking about that ultimately. Like, that's not something that we're even focusing on if one of those things hadn't been the case. We've just blown right through breaks and things like crazy yet again. It is happy hour at your local alternative, Solid State Radio. It is an overreaction Monday on happy hour. You know how this goes by now. Things happened in the NFL over the weekend, and some of them even weren't related to your Detroit Football Lions. We get the overreactions, and we decide what actually is, what's real, what's an actual overreaction, and what's just plain true. Maestro, the music, please.
Week 2 is almost in the books. Just a game going on tonight. So we're going to talk about some overreactions. Or is it an overreaction? Is this, in fact, reality? We start with Zach Taylor. Zach Taylor won't last the season as Bengals head coach. Is that an overreaction, or is that reality?
That is... I don't know. I still think it's an overreaction 2 weeks in. I mean... This team always starts slow. They have always started slow. Like, I believe in the first, 2 weeks of the season, over the course of Joe Burrow and Zach Taylor's tenure in Cincy, they've won once. That's just what happens. They've lost 7 straight games in weeks 1 and 2. But they always finish with a winning record at least in those last 2 seasons. I mean, they'll probably get burned eventually. I don't think there's any chance that Zach Taylor is gone during the season. I mean, if Cincy were to miss the playoffs this year, sure, I could see it. If you miss the playoffs back-to-back years, then yeah, you're probably donezo. But I don't see this team being that bad, ultimately, to not be able to overcome a slow start yet again. I mean, Burrow did have a relatively healthy training camp. He should be, at full speed right now, but this is just how this team's always gone.
Yeah, but if you're a Bengals fan, it's got to get frustrating. Season after season, going into week 3, 0-2, there's a lot of ground you could make up at the very... It's like, you got to start on time. And what's with this coach, or are they blaming the coach, that he can't get this team in playing shape in weeks 1 and 2?
Well, they blame the coach, they blame the QB, they're blaming everybody out there. Mm-hmm. They played KC and lost a close game against the defending Super Bowl champions. Am I really supposed to sit here and be just appalled and start freaking out that, oh my God, you lost to the team that just won it all last season on a last second field goal? Yeah, oh my God, fire everybody. I'm sorry, I can't get on board with that. It's not like since he didn't put up its fair share of offense, Burrow threw for 3 touchdowns, had 258 yards on the day. Your rushing game was basically non-existent, but certainly that doesn't fall on Joe Burrow by any means. As far as KC, you held Pat Mahomes to 151 yards and got him picked off twice. I'm not willing to write the book on Zach Taylor's career in Cincy yet. That's an overreaction yet to me.
All right. The Rams, the stupid Rams.
Thank you.
Will finish last in the NFC West.
Oh, also, if I could point out one more thing on the Bengals. They play the Commanders next week, a bottom feeder in this league if ever there was. They play the Panthers after that, and the Ravens are 0-2. I think we'll be okay. Oh, and the G-Men a couple weeks after that. They've got a schedule that sets them up nicely to turn it around from here. So the Rams will finish last?
Finish dead last in the NFC West. Is that reality or is that an overreaction?
Well, you do have a couple big problems there. Obviously, Puka Nacua is dead. Cooper Kupp was in a walking boot.
I didn't see that headline.
Cooper Kupp is in a walking boot after the game yesterday. That's not promising. Stafford, without his top two weapons, could be a major problem real quick. And not only that, but you're losing. You've got two O-line guys that are on injured reserve. Joe Noteboom and Steve Avila, both on injured reserve. You'll remember last week, Kevin Dodson and Jonah Jackson were the only O-linemen who started that game and finished it. Tyler Higbee is still rehabbing from a torn ACL. There is a lot that has to go right for this team to have a chance. All of Stafford's weapons are gone. His entire offensive line is gone. If he manages to survive and keep this team out of the basement in the NFC West, that dude should be given the MVP just in his own right. But looking at yesterday, a total of 10 points on the day for LA. The lone touchdown being a rushing TD from Kyren Williams. Blake Corum still not doing a whole lot. Although he did, to be fair, in his 8 carries, did average 3.5 yards a carry yesterday. But that is not going to be enough to get this team in any kind of contention. I mean, your leading guy yesterday on the in your receiving core was DeMarcus Robinson, and he had just 2 catches for 50 yards. That sort of boom or bust thing does not bode well for the future of this team without basically all of its playmakers on offense, save for Stafford. The Seahawks have definitely gotten better from last year. San Fran's going to be in the thick of it no matter what. It seems like early on, the Cardinals have improved as well. We'll see how much that's the case when they come and when they take on the Lions next week. But it's certainly looking like if these injuries are as long-term as they appear to be, especially with the Cooper Kupp thing, I think that could be that very much is a reality.
All right, the Ravens will miss the playoffs.
Okay. This kind of comes back to the Bengals thing earlier. Yeah, they started off 0-2, and they have a nice just cupcake schedule ahead of them, and people are already writing off Zach Taylor as being the coach of this thing by the time the season finished. Okay, the Ravens lost their first 2 games to start, and they ended up losing against the Raiders, and yeah, I will say there's no excuse in losing to that team and losing to Gardner Minshew at that. Sorry, should be happening. The first week was against the Chiefs, though. This is their first 0-2 start in almost a decade under John Harbaugh. On their previous 0-2 starts in franchise history, this team has failed to finish with a winning record or make the playoffs, but they have the fourth best total yard differential by an 0-2 team in the Super Bowl, plus 222. They're moving the ball. They had a lead going into the fourth quarter and ultimately blew it. And there's no reason to suggest by past history that this isn't the kind of thing that they can overcome. And those 2 losses were by a combined 10 points. Now, let's see how they do against Dallas, Buffalo, and Cincy before we start writing the book on the Ravens season. Overreaction, at least for the next 3 weeks.
All right. Oh, here we go.
Oh, I'm scared.
Geno Smith is the most clutch quarterback in the NFL.
I don't think I believe that for a second. I don't understand how Geno Smith has managed to make it this far as a starting QB in the NFL. Like, how this guy who was basically destined to be a career backup after he bottomed out in New York and somehow ends up in Seattle and ends up being the guy, and ended up being an all-pro the last 2 seasons. None of this should ever have happened, and I still, for the life of me, don't understand exactly how it has.
Talk about failing upwards.
Yeah, but somehow, he failed right into a position where he has really thrived. He's not the most clutch QB as long as Patrick Mahomes exists. But yeah, let's be honest, this dude keeps the Seahawks in games better than pretty much anybody. Led them downfield to a game-tying field goal drive in the last minute of regulation. And the game-winning drive ultimately in overtime. Got to give the man credit. Give the man his flowers. I mean, granted, it was against the Patriots, who no one expects to be good. But when it counts, he's about as good as they get. He was 11 for 14 for 103 yards in the fourth quarter and OT combined. Has thrown 10 touchdown passes to just one interception in the fourth quarter overtime span since the start of last year. He's not to be the man, you got to beat the man. And Mahomes is still the man until someone proves otherwise.
Oh, yeah.
But Geno is definitely in that clutch tier at this point. Overreaction, but not by much.
All right. Is this an overreaction or is this reality? Saints have the best offense in the NFC.
I mean, it was the worst team in the NFL that they played. Grant, you're still hanging 47 points on anybody, saying a lot. But I can't. I'd like to say that, no, this isn't a real thing. I'd like to say it's an overreaction because I have no faith in Derek Carr. And I don't think the Saints really had that much faith in Derek Carr either. But somehow, the Saints have scored on 16 of their 20 possessions this season. They've averaged 32.5 points per game in the first half. They've got the fourth most points through two games in NFL history, 91 points. Apparently, they're the fifth team in NFL history to have 44 or more points in three straight games dating back to last year. And while it's hard to, it's easy to sit and dismiss because, Derek Carr, he's washed. To say he's washed implies he was ever anything. But here's the thing. When you got guys like Alvin Kamara, who is looking like his old self, you've got Rashid Shaheed and Chris Olave, you have some really, really talented playmakers on that roster. It's easy to see why this is happening and why they have such an explosive offense the way they do. I have to say, until proven otherwise, that, yeah, they're the best offense in the league until someone knocks them off. I don't know when exactly that's going to happen. I mean, they did hang 44 points on Dallas. You can't take that away from them. Like, give the team their flowers. Like, Cowboys have historically had a fairly stout defense, and you hung 44 on it and held Dak Prescott and company to 19 points. That in itself is cause to say, okay, this is reality.
How about this? Trevor Lawrence is not a franchise quarterback. Is that reality or is that an overreaction?
I'm kind of over the hype train on this guy. I'm not going to lie to you. I wanted to see him do well. I really wanted to see this guy thrive. Like, he got such a raw deal during the Urban Meyer era at his first season in Jacksonville, like one of the worst teams to ever take the field. I wanted him to be that guy. I wanted to think, yeah, he can step up. He could do this. He could be that guy. And thus far, it hasn't been that case. He struggled again on Sunday. He's now lost seven straight starts. Their last win came against Carolina, a garbage team, and Trevor Lawrence didn't even play that game. Like, you're paying this guy a lot of money to be as bad as he is. Like, you're paying him to step up and win you games. You paid him to be him. And Trevor Lawrence has not been him this season, or really to this point in his career. Like, he's got to turn it around quick. Otherwise, I think it might be fair to start saying this guy might be a bust. At the very least, you're going to be able to say he's not a franchise caliber QB. I think that's a fair statement at this point in his career.
All right.
Absolutely reality.
We move on. Marvin Harrison Jr. will get 1,000 yards in his rookie year.
Absolutely. Four catches for 130 yards and two touchdowns yesterday over the Rams. A 23-yard touchdown and a 60-yard touchdown. All of his yards was in the opening quarter. Didn't he have to play the rest of the game and do much anything else from there just because he was that good? I mean, obviously, teams are eventually, like, they're going to catch up to him. That's how this always goes. Like, no one necessarily manages to do that all year long, and he did start off pretty slow, certainly against the Bills, where he only got targeted 3 times on the day. But he's averaging right now 26.8 yards a catch. That's not going to hold up. But he is on pace for 1,139 yards this season, which would break, which would at least come close to the rookie franchise record from Anquan Boldin of 1,377 yards. I don't think he's going to break the record. I think he'll break 1,000. I absolutely think that if he keeps doing what he does.
Rookie of the year?
I think you can make an argument for offensive rookie of the year. Very strong argument for that. Absolutely. He's going to be that guy. He's showing very early on that he is absolutely capable of living up to all the hype, that he is the best wide receiver in this draft class.
All right.
There's our pick. There's our overreactions for the week.
No, I got one more.
Okay.
Reality or overreaction. Dan Campbell will be thrown out of an Applebee's this season.
Probably not. If we don't have any more boneheaded moves like the end of the first or the second quarter yesterday, no, he won't be getting banned from any Applebee's anytime soon. Make sure you cover your mouth when you're ordering, though.
Yeah. I'm just thinking maybe he has too many of those $1 margaritas.
Yeah, you're right.
Eye of the Tiger comes on the Muzak.
Yeah, that guy is $1 Long Island away from cutting a wrestling promo pretty much at all times, honestly, which is one of the things that endears him to us all so much.
Yes,
that he really does seem like a guy who should be, you know, talking about how he's gonna beat down Hulk Hogan or something. Yeah. Like, that is kind of the everyman appeal of this dude. But I've said it from the beginning, you live by the Dan Gamble, you die by the Dan Gamble. But but there are some things that can't be overlooked, can't be dismissed, and some things that have to be addressed, and I think they will. I think these are things that they will get straight before next week against Arizona. It is Happy Hour at your local alternative, Solid State Radio. Let's go ahead and touch on a little college football, shall we, as there is news over in your camp, so I hear.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, apparently you're getting a new quarterback.
Oh, no kidding.
This cat by the name of Alex Orji is going to be the...
Alexa, rewind 30 seconds. What'd you say?
Alex Orji, O-R-J-I.
It sure it is. We're all playing now, folks.
So, yeah, Alex Orji will be getting the start against the USC Trojans on Saturday. The jokes, folks, they just write themselves, really.
Trojan man.
So, it was kind of a move that was expected to be made real quick because Davis Warren went out against Arkansas State.
Yeah.
I forgot there was an Arkansas State, and he threw 3 picks against him.
Yeah, we're going to play at your place because we don't have a field.
Like, I don't know how this happened, but he went 11 for 14 on Saturday, and all 3 of those passes that he didn't complete, well, he completed them just to the other team. 6 interceptions now across 3 games this season.
Yep.
How something like that happens, and I have no idea how he's honestly kept the gig for that long. Like, he's had such a terrible year. For what it's worth, Orji ended up coming in and getting a touchdown, completing 2 of his 4 passes for 12 yards on the day. Looked certainly a lot better out there in that offense than Davis Warren did. The problem is now, though, that you're going to kind of have to adjust the offense on the fly because Orji's kind of he's more of a dual threat kind of guy. Like, they're going to have to kind of work around that. He's a guy who's got 181 rushing yards and 3 rushing scores on 31 carries in his career, 5.8 yards a carry, which is rather nice. Like, he's going to be a guy that can do both. He can run, he can throw the ball pretty well, and you're now going to have to kind of reconfigure your entire offense to work around him, whereas if you just would have done what needed to be done in the first place and named him the starter before all this went down, you might have not had to worry about any of that.
Oh, look at Captain Hindsight over here.
Well, I mean, I think anyone could have told you this Davis-Warren experiment wasn't going to end particularly well. Moore also says he doesn't anticipate going back to Warren. Quote, that's going to be our guy. That's who we're going to ride with. And it's going to be a to say the least, it's going to be a tough task to go and take on USC. They're favored by 6.5 on Saturday. And you are absolutely going to have to keep the turnovers to an absolute minimum, 0 if possible, if you're going to have a chance of pulling this thing off. My, I wasn't expecting QB controversy to happen, though, this early in the season for U of M. This, I'm not sure that this matchup favors you and this year favors you, my dude.
No. Oh, no. I mean, there's not too many Michigan fans who are like, oh, absolutely, we're going to repeat. No way. It's you know what it reminds me of is, you remember Dukes of Hazzard when, you know, Bo and Luke left and we were left with Coy and Vance?
Ah, yes. I'd forgotten about
Coy
that.
Coy and Vance, and they tried to play it off like it was, you know, no big deal. Oh, same kind of show and everything. And we're like, no. It's not Bo and Luke. So, no dice.
Nobody cared.
Nope. Nobody cared. I didn't care. I was like 5 or 6. I'm like, this is stupid.
This is dumb. Why would they even keep going with the show at that point?
Right. Exactly. They tried to do the spinoff Enos. I'm like, let's take the least known character and do a spinoff called Enos.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, that was really well planned out.
I think it lasted like a third of an episode. It was like before the first commercial break. They're like, this is stupid.
Right.
Put on the Tonight Show. today's guest, the star of Enos. Oh, never mind. We found him hanging in his dressing room.
Jesus.
We'll be back after this.
I can't believe that. I can't believe that whole thing lasted as long as it did with those two. But yeah, that's you're not entirely wrong. This is not certainly the Michigan team of years past. And by that, I mean a year past.
Quorum's not there.
Donovan Edwards is still there and just has not been, for whatever reason, really.
It's a different atmosphere.
Yeah, he hasn't been that involved all that much. Like, he's been proven to be a pretty decent receiving threat, even, and might actually be a solid option going forward with this with your new QB. Like, he hasn't been incorporated really into the passing game thus far at all this season. Like his running hasn't been up to certainly what you expect from him. Like this week against, again, Arkansas State, you had 17 carries. You did get a touchdown, but 17 carries for only 82 yards. Khalil Mullings got the vast majority of your rushing yardage and touchdowns on the day, but he hasn't been used really as a pass catching option at all. Ellis is one of those things where, you know, they're trying to hide all these options and things early on in the season, but he only got one. He only had one catch on Saturday, and for an 11 yards, like, that's not bad by any means. I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head how many times he got targeted, but it's not like he's not a very good option there, and you're probably better off, if anything, making Orji try to beat guys through the air as opposed to just solely the rushing thing, because he can do both, and he does both fairly well. So that's something certainly that has to be taken into consideration here. Edwards has had 200 or more rushing yards in each of his last three seasons. You'd like to see more of him. You'd like to see more of him in general involved in this offense. I can't sit here and say that I think that you could beat USC.
No.
I'd be a damned liar if I told you that.
No, it's not looking good.
And this is going to be your toughest matchup, but no, that was Texas. But USC is certainly not by any means been slouches this year. They're currently ranked 11th in the nation. They went and faced LSU in week one and ended up beating them 27-20. LSU, man, like they squeaked one out against South Carolina this week. I'm kind of wondering if they are who we thought they were, but that's a whole other thing for another day. But they can hang with the best of the best, USC can. They blew out Utah State last week. See, they take care of their cupcake games the way that you need to take care of the cupcake games. Like, there was no doubt at any point that State was going to ever make it close against Prairie View, and honestly, I was kind of worried that that was the exact thing that would happen. I'll be perfectly honest. I thought it was going to be the opposite of what happened here, where they were going to make this way too close of a game against Prairie View, a school that I'm pretty sure somebody at ESPN just made up, and that Michigan were going to go and blow out Arkansas State. And neither of those things end up being the case. Yeah, the State was favored by 40. They got 40 and completely shut out Prairie View A&M for whatever it's worth. Apparently, I guess the whole thing behind that was a schedule replacement for the Louisiana Ragin' Cajuns for some reason or another. But at least they went out and did what they needed to do.
Yes, like, they did.
Give props where props are due. When faced with a nothing burger of an opponent, they went out and took care of business and didn't make it look overly close. They now face Boston College this weekend, and this is one that it's going to be a challenge. This is a team that just fell out of the top 25. They started off their season beating number 10 Florida State, which, an aside on that, if I could, my, Florida State fell from grace so quickly this year. Like, they dropped their first game to Georgia Tech. They went and got manhandled by Boston College. And then this week, they go and lose to Memphis. And I've heard rumors already that the boosters there are taking up a collection to buy out Billy Napier's contract. And quite frankly, I don't blame them. Like, that has to be very much in consideration right now, the way that team, like, I've never seen a top 10 ranked team come out its first three games and look so completely, utterly abysmal and just drop out of everything that quickly. I can't remember the last time I've seen a team fall from grace quite that swiftly and suddenly and basically capped it off against Memphis. Like, I don't think there's any chance this team gets it together this season. If they finish above 500, I'll be impressed. But they lost to Boston College in week two of the year. But then Boston College's own star has kind of fallen of late. They shut out Duquesne by like 56-0, and then they went into number 6, Missouri. They went and took on Mizzou and lost by 6 points, which ended up knocking Boston College completely out of the top 25. I think that plus realizing that, yeah, Florida State really is as bad as they are, certainly contributed. Like, you only got into the top 25 because you beat a team that was expected to contend for a natty or at least be in the chase this year. And then once it turned out that they were frauds, well, I guess you're getting booted out too. But they got something to prove then this week against State. Boston College is, of course, favored by 7. Because they have actually still beaten one team with some semblance of a track record and resume. Meanwhile, State has beaten Maryland, I guess. That's really been it. It's been a garbage preseason, such as it is. Yeah. For lack of a better term, it's been a pretty bad preseason. Non-conference schedule there. So I don't necessarily expect State to come out and do what needs to be done here, because you do have in Castellanos for Boston College, you have a guy who's thus far, he's thrown for 9 touchdowns to 2 picks. He's got almost 600 yards on the season. Aiden Childs has more yards than he does, but the completion percentage is a lot rougher than that, and he still has more picks than touchdowns this season thus far. A total of 4 touchdowns across those 3 games. That is a bit disappointing. 5 picks, even more so. Granted, you may have righted the ship against the easiest opponent you'll play all season last week, but I admittedly, I'm not picking them to go on a tear here. If they can beat Boston College, though, okay, maybe I can be convinced that you can, you know, beat Michigan, beat Iowa. I'm not going to say you're beating Ohio State or Oregon. That's That's going a little too far for my liking, but also, to be fair, I'm not even saying that Michigan's going to beat either of those teams this year. Like, wow, Oregon might come in and just start just dominating in the Big Ten real quick. Like, they've won so far all of their games, and they've already played, well, their in-state rival in Boise State for whatever they might be worth. But I don't see that this is going to be if State wins this game, this could certainly bolster the confidence of that squad going forward. But I'd be lying to you if I told you that I expected them to pull off the W here. We're going to hit a quick break, come back, and close things off here on an Overreaction Monday. Stick around.
It's over.
Jack Daniels!
Well, while we still have a few minutes left in the show, let's touch on the Tigers a little bit, shall we? Because this team somehow, miraculously, has managed to keep itself in playoff contention. We talked a little bit on Friday when they dropped the last game of their series to the Colorado Rockies, and I'm just sitting there thinking, oh no, this is where it all falls apart, isn't it? They're not gonna do this thing now. Thinking, oh, you've got to go in and play Baltimore for three games, the best team in the AL East. This is going to end just horrifically badly, isn't it? Just setting myself up for the absolute worst because this is just kind of what I ended up doing. But you had that, and you also had Minnesota going in to face the Cincinnati Reds, a team that hasn't tried to win baseball games since sometime in the 90s. And I'm just thinking, oh, great. This is where it starts, isn't it? This is where we just bottom right back out again. But then a funny thing happened. A couple funny things happened. The Tigers taking on a team that is very much still in danger of losing their place in the divisional race. That's still very much in play to be the best team in the AL East. They and the Yankees have been kind of going back and forth. New York are currently three games up in that race, actually. But they went to Comerica Park to take on the O's, and somehow, I'm still not entirely sure how it happened, but they ended up taking two out of three from arguably one of the best teams in the American League.
And that game they lost, we were watching it over at Cascade and Lounge. And they made it interesting.
They certainly did. It was very, very interesting towards the end. They certainly had their chances. Meanwhile, the Tigers on Friday basically nearly threw a combined no-hitter, threw two outs in the ninth. Gunnar Henderson ended up breaking that up. But that was another one of those bullpen days. Bo Breeski got the quote-unquote start, and Brant Herder ended up pitching the majority of that game. But like, that's one of those games where you're just expecting to lose because you don't even really have a starter that day. And then somehow Saturday, you're at least still in contention pretty deep into that game, like thinking, all right, they might yet be able to pull this off. And then ultimately they weren't able to do that, but still kept it surprisingly close. Then Sunday, you go out there and beat the O's by a score of 4-2 behind Keeter Montero, putting up another just masterclass in pitching. That guy, he has been everything you could have possibly hoped for him so far this season. Gave up no runs in his five innings of work. And then the back end of your bullpen ended up closing that thing out fine. Meanwhile, the Twins picked a fine time to lose 2 out of 3 to the lowly Reds. So not only did you not lose ground to the race, you gained a game on Minnesota. Unfortunately, Seattle's back in the thick of it now, and that's a little bit of a problem. They are now tied with you going into tonight's matchup against the Royals. A three-game set starts tonight at 7:40. Of course, you can hear that all on our sister station, the Thumb's Greatest Hits, 97.7 WTGV. The Twins now find themselves going into a matchup against the best team in this division, the Cleveland Guardians. They're looking at a three-game skid on the road at this point. They need to snap that in pretty short order against Cleveland, and they're hoping they'll be able to do that. But they, here's the fun part. They have to play four games against the best team in our division, whereas the Tigers get to face KC and hopefully make up some more ground there. And Cleveland is not by any means rolling over here. Yeah, they've got the division fairly cinched up. KC is four games back from them yet, but they're playing for the first overall in the American League. Like, they're just a game behind the Yankees at this point, for whatever that might be worth. They're not out of it by any means, and they're going to be going in there presumably doing their best to put the smack down on division rival. And all of a sudden, this ridiculousness about the Tigers being in contention to play meaningful baseball into late September doesn't seem quite as ridiculous as it did perhaps this time last week.
Yeah.
I admit, I like the odds probably a lot more than I should, considering that this is once again going to be one of those days where we don't know who's actually pitching. They haven't said who's pitching this game. Casey Mize is supposed to go tomorrow, and I believe that means Tarek Skubal will be going on Wednesday. So I guess what that means is that it's going to be another one of those wonderful bullpen days that we love so, so much here in Detroit. But the stupid thing is that it seems to be working. Like, those are the games we're winning. Like, we just send a Breeski or whoever to go out and pitch an inning and then let a Ty Madden or a Brant Herter take it the rest of the way. And those games we win. Meanwhile, you have your ace go out there and start against Colorado, and that's a game you lose. Really? How does this even happen? How this team does what it does just utterly confounds me sometimes. Like, there's no rhyme or reason to how they do what they do or why they do what they do. But the important thing is that when it comes down to it, it seems to work when they need it to. So I've just gotten to the point where I'm not even questioning it. Screw it. Do it. Do whatever. Throw out whatever guy from the middle of the bullpen to make the start and give one of your, like, seventh inning guys a chance to open the game, and you'll probably end up winning because that's just kind of what this team does. It's weird. I don't understand why it's played out this way, but somehow it has. I'm not going to complain about it either because it's been rather nice still playing meaningful baseball on September 16th.
Yeah.
If you'd have told me at the start of this season that this would be the case, that we wouldn't have been fully eliminated from playoff contention.
We had them written off in the end of April.
We did. I would have laughed in your face and told you were absolutely full of it. I mean, you came in and did not have the greatest start to the season. We figured, well, there's no really much anything. There's no hitting here. Of course, we're gonna be terrible again this year, and that's what we thought. Oh, how wrong we were. Every so often, baseball will do that to you, though, I guess.
Yep.
You find a team that has no business being in contention sometimes does and sometimes even makes it. I'm still giving serious thought to going that last weekend of the season when they play Chicago. Partially because, and I guess that's a good place to segue into our update on Chicago being the worst team in the history of baseball. Right now, as of today, Chicago's at 115 losses. They only need six more losses to achieve all-time infamy. And they go into, I don't believe they're playing tonight, but they are going into a set coming up here against, they are playing tonight against Anaheim. And Anaheim doesn't have a lot to play for. They're clearly out of it. The only reason people show up to games is when Ohtani comes over when they're playing the Dodgers. Because, let's be honest, you have nothing to watch if you're an Angels fan at this point.
No.
You've basically watched your team take two of arguably the greatest talents ever to play the game, two guys who are going to be first ballot Hall of Famers, and basically waste good chunks of their careers. You almost got to feel bad for Angels fans
yeah.
in some capacity.
A little bit.
But the White Sox at least have the opportunity here to play a team that isn't going to be playing for anything and might, as such, kind of maybe roll over a bit. I mean, the Athletics, they play them over the weekend, and White Sox end up taking 2 of 3 from them, which I was really hoping that wasn't going to be the case, but kind of expected it would. Then you have the Padres after that, who are fairly still in contention as far as their second place in the NL West right now, and I believe they are currently in a wild card spot. So they're still very much going to be trying when you face them. The 6 games against the Angels might be the only thing that saves you at this point if you're Chicago. And then, of course, you know the Tigers are going to be coming hungry that last weekend, especially if they have managed to overtake the Twins by then or have the chance to overtake the Twins by then. I'm giving serious thoughts to going to that game on that last Saturday in September. Like, tickets are still ridiculously cheap right now. I probably should be giving that away on there, but tickets are only like $8, man. Like, you could go and get some decent seats to watch your team make the playoffs and watch your rival be terrible. On that note, a full hour of local original music comes your way next on a little show we like to call Solid State Sessions. All being well, talk to you tomorrow at 3. See ya.